Welcome back, everyone, to episode number 30 of Raw Health Radio. And joining me today to talk about food, the adrenals, and women's health, we've got Nora Gedgaudas, who is an absolute paleo advocate and a champion of the paleo world. Now, she's the author of Primal Body, Primal Mind. She's a board-certified clinical nutritionist and a board-certified neurofeedback specialist. She's the co-author of Going Paleo with Pete Evans, who's a friend of this show, and she works out of Portland, Oregon, well-known in the fitness industry. Nora, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Very well. I'm very excited to have you on the show today. So why don't we start out with a bit of a story about who you are and how you came to do what it is that you do?
Oh, boy. That's a long, convoluted story. You know, I developed an interest in nutritional science probably about 35 years ago now, in part because of a lifelong pervasive issue with depression and also anxiety and panic attacks that hadn't responded to anything. And I learned that I could change the way I felt with what it was that I ate or what it was that I chose to supplement with. And so I became, you know, kind of hooked early on with the idea that using nutrients can have a profound impact on the way we feel and function, and that we can manipulate the way we feel and function quite a bit by implementing these things in a variety of ways. And so it's sort of what got me started down that long trail. I found that neurofeedback was something that's totally, of course, off topic here, but that was something that really provided me with a wonderful adjunct to that nutritional approach and made just a tremendous difference for me. And I knew by hook or by crook that I wanted to take what I had learned with everything I had done and apply that to helping others who were similarly suffering. And so I've been a neurofeedback provider now for over 20 years and in private practice for about a little over a dozen years now. And it's been, you know, extremely richly rewarding. And I've managed to notice along the way a lot of different things. You know, I tend to see clients over an extended period of time. Those that come to me for neurofeedback, I see a couple times a week over a period of 6 months or more. So I was able to work with people nutritionally in a lot more effective way than just, you know, maybe meeting once or twice a year kind of a thing and talking about, well, you know, here, you know, read this book or here's a set of guidelines, give it a go and let me know how you do. But really kind of handholding people through an extended process of dietary changes and being able to watch and see what it is that works and what doesn't work. And along the way, and I've been able to kind of tweak that my approaches, you know, based on the kind of feedback that I've gotten over many years. And in addition to the fact that I stay very much on top of kind of the current literature and the current information that's influxing now like a tsunami, you know, in the fields of things like immunology and adrenal related issues. And I mean, pretty much every related field, anything related to nutrition is just coming in like a tsunami right now. And as much as humanly possible, I do a lot of continuing education. And I'm always, you know, questioning even my own assumptions about things and testing, you know, my hypotheses about new ideas and things like that in a way that it helps me arrive at the best possible information, you know, that I can impart. And again, it's a process and constantly learning and constantly developing and learning. Learning and developing new concepts, but it's an exciting time to be involved in this kind of work because there's just so much information now that we just didn't even have a decade ago.
Mm, absolutely. Now, the topic of this show is based around the adrenals, and there might be some people out there who are listening who kind of get what they are but not fully understand. So what exactly are the adrenals and what do they do?
Well, your adrenal glands are a couple of basically, hormone factories sitting on top of, your stress hormone factories, if you will, that are sitting on top of each of your kidneys, a little bit like a bit of a cap. And they're not very big, but they have a big job to do. And what they do is basically they secrete these chemical messengers that communicate with your brain and your metabolism and your immune system and help you manage various stressors in your life. And, your adrenal gland basically has two parts. You have an adrenal medulla that basically releases what are called the catecholamine hormones, like adrenaline, which is sometimes also called epinephrine, and small amounts of what are called noradrenaline or norepinephrine, which is mainly kind of your brain's version of adrenaline. And then there's the outer adrenal cortex, which releases some adrenal and other steroid hormones, like your sex hormones, for instance, including things like DHEA and also other corticosteroids, including cortisone and something else called aldosterone. But when people talk about adrenal-related issues, they're mostly referring to problems with their cortisol levels. Either they're making too much cortisol or they're making not enough. Or they think, the popular mantra is that, oh, I've got adrenal burnout. My adrenals are just kind of toast, or they're very fatigued, and try as I might, I can't seem to get them to work better. And there it's kind of a pervasive mythology, and that mythology is largely based upon the fact that most of what goes on today with respect to books and even a lot of natural health care providers that talk about these various stages of adrenal exhaustion, etc., are really based on 1950s science or 1950s, scientific theory. And the father of the study of stress was this brilliant Canadian endocrinologist by the name of Dr. Hans Selye. And, he nominated multiple times for the Nobel Prize. So, this guy wasn't any kind of slouch. He was a meticulous scientist, and he advanced theories about stress that seemed plausible at the time. And in fact, his model of stress is this as being part and parcel of these progressive stages of adrenal exhaustion was accepted for many, many years as sort of the standard model of stress physiology. And it's still, of course, it's still being taught in natural healthcare circles. I learned it too once upon a time. Now, in conventional medicine, they don't recognize that there's anything wrong with you unless you have Addison's disease or Cushing's disease or something like that. They don't see any such thing as progressive adrenal exhaustion. But they also don't really recognize the idea of adrenal dysregulation. Now, there is the truth, as it turns out, lies somewhere in the middle of all of this. That what Hans Selye put forward is this model of progressive adrenal exhaustion. It turns out, modern stress research, modern day stress researchers and physiologists, will tell you that that model just doesn't hold up. That's not really how it works. It seemed logical enough in the beginning. Selye said, well, there's this initial alarm or acute stage where you're producing all this, maybe too much cortisol, you're producing lots and lots of it. And then there's a resistance stage where cortisol levels can either be high or low. And eventually there's this exhaustion stage where cortisol becomes chronically depressed due to just the state of adrenal exhaustion or burnout. And they even get subdivided into all kinds of other progressive phases of adrenal exhaustion. It goes on and on and on. But I mean, he was right about some things, but as it relates, that when it comes to stress physiology, as it relates to adrenal function, it really isn't accepted anymore as accurate by today's researchers. So, they don't nece stress and adrenal related issues don't necessarily progress in predictable stages. In fact, now that we have better and a lot more affordable testing, it's easy to see these patterns literally change practically overnight, that you go suddenly from a state of what looks too low to a state of what looks too high, and almost everything in between. So we know that there's something else going on. But the bottom line is this, that your adrenal glands are just basically two little hormone factories as sitting on top of your kidneys trying to do their job. And they do what they're told to do by your brain. And so if they're not doing what they're supposed to do, the first place to look is brain. You know, the first place to look is what is going on with you neurologically, and what form of brain dysregulation might you have that is leading to some form of adrenal dysregulation or other. And yes, you can have very abnormal patterns of cortisol, you know, cortisol release, but there are a lot of things mitigating that that have nothing whatever to do with your adrenal glands themselves. They're, you know, they may be just fine. Or if you, in the case of having something like subclinical Addison's disease, which is literally an autoimmune disorder where you, where your immune system is literally destroying its own tissue and it's focused on your adrenal tissue, then that too really isn't a glandular problem. That's an immune problem. And that needs to be addressed on that level in order to be, you know, effectively managed. But in any case, we're never really talking about what can be accurately defined as adrenal burnout. That isn't really what happens.
So if someone gets to the point where their adrenals are burned out, what might that look and feel like?
Well, again, there really isn't such a thing as adrenal burnout, but there are definitely symptoms that are associated with not having, you know, for instance, your adrenal function not being up to snuff. If your adrenal function is chronically depressed, then you might be chronically depressed, you know, or if you're, I mean, your cortisol production is chronically depressed. You need to look at things like, I'm getting ahead of myself. The symptoms are going to be probably fatigue. And you may notice abnormal levels of fatigue at certain times of the day where it's not supposed to be there, like in the morning where you're supposed to be refreshed and up and at 'em. Depending on what type of depressed cortisol pattern you might have, if your cortisol is depressed in the morning, you're going to find it very hard to get out of bed. You know, the snooze button on your alarm clock is going to be totally worn out. And you're going to find it, you know, really hard to get up and get moving. These are the people that, you know, that have the philosophy of no coffee, no worky, you know, that they need a pot of coffee just to kind of resurrect themselves, or a cigarette or something in the morning. Yeah. They get out of bed in order to get moving. That's not normal. Something is interfering with their ability to produce sufficient cortisol to get them kind of up and at 'em in the morning. And very frequently also people with overly depressed cortisol levels will find that they have big cravings for not just stimulants, but carbohydrates. They'll have a lot of sugar cravings and starch cravings, and you know, they may be hypoglycemic a lot of the time. And interestingly, a lot of times people that are hypoglycemic also tend to be anxiety prone. Anxiety and depression, of course, are sort of two sides of a similar coin. But because when your blood sugar is low and you're dependent on blood sugar as your primary source of fuel, which I'll just point out as an aside, is not actually the natural metabolic state of humans, but it's the way most people in our culture or society, you know, it's the type of metabolism most people in our society have cultivated. Then when your blood sugar drops, it kind of becomes an emergency. And then you may not be able to produce sufficient cortisol, but your body's kicking out adrenaline, you know, the other adrenal hormone. And that, of course, is a fight or flight hormone that might make you feel anxious or jittery. At the same time, you're probably craving that, you know, that 10 o'clock a.m. donut or, you know, whatever, or that trip to Starbucks. And that those surges in blood sugar that are created by that type of dysregulation also will create an inflammatory response. So there are a lot of, things going on with that that can result in you feeling and functioning less than your best.
So what about some other things with regards to food that can affect the adrenals? So you mentioned that having low blood sugar is one. Is that because
Well,
people don't eat frequently enough or because they're eating the wrong kinds of foods?
so this is a complicated question because, what I advocate for is adopting a metabolic, sort of adopting a type of metabolism that is going to be dependent on not sugar as its primary source of fuel, but fat as its primary source of fuel, which is demonstrably the most natural metabolic state for human beings. And when you're relying on fat as a primary source of fuel, then you take blood sugar out of that mood, cognitive, and energy equation. Your level of blood sugar matters less. You don't need to eat as often. Your energy levels and mood and all of that operate in a much more even keel for a much more prolonged period of time, even in the absence of regular meals. But for somebody that is sort of enslaved to relying on kindling as their primary source of fuel, which is how I refer to carbohydrates, then they are going to have to eat regularly, if not almost constantly, in order to maintain some, even level of blood sugar. Your body's obsessed with maintaining the lowest level of blood sugar it has to have at any given time, because blood sugar is very inflammatory. It's very glycating, and glycating means that it will combine with these proteins in your body and your tissues and cause them to become sticky and misshapen and start to malfunction. It gloms onto your red blood cells and causes them to become glycated, which can be measured in something called a hemoglobin A1C, which looks at long-term glycation and is a marker for in elevated levels as a marker for instance, diabetes. And so it's not a good thing. And glycation is also something that profoundly affects the brain. The brain tissue is very, very vulnerable to the effects of glycation. And so your body just doesn't want more blood sugar than it has to have at any given time. So your body's always working on keeping it down. But if it gets too low, that becomes an emergency for somebody that's dependent on blood sugar. And so they're constantly walking that tightrope between too low and too high. And that gives their insulin production a workout, which is a vector for premature aging, cancer, diabetes, heart disease, and obesity, other metabolic problems. And it requires a lot of management. I personally have better things to do with my time than constantly, manage my blood sugar. Now, some people have bigger problems with this than others, but I can give you a quick quiz, or your audience a quick quiz, to help them figure out whether or not they have a problem with blood sugar.
That sounds good. Let's do that.
So let me ask you this, that if you've gone for, say, 6 or 7 hours or something like that without eating anything, how you doing with that? Do you feel kind of, do you start to feel fatigued? Do you start to feel kind of brain fog? Do you feel a little jittery or maybe agitated or cranky or that little something maybe that rhymes with itchy? And then the second question is, and then once you've actually eaten something, how do you feel after you've eaten? Do you immediately feel better? Do you immediately feel like, wow, now I can take on the world. I've got a lot of energy. I feel great. I feel fabulous. Thank God I ate something. Or do you feel a little tired? Are you one of those people that eats a meal and then, kind of wants to go over to the couch and plop down and unzip your, unbutton that top button on your pants and kind of slide your hand in your belt area to just kind of take a nap, right? If you've said yes to any of the things I just described, you've got a problem. So to backpedal back to the first question of how do you feel or how are you supposed to feel when you haven't eaten for an extended period of time, say 6, 7 hours or something like that. which would be a lot of time for a lot of people. How do you feel? Or how are you supposed to feel? There is only one answer to that question that is normal. And the answer to that question is hungry. The only thing you are supposed to feel when you haven't eaten for an extended period of time is hungry.
So you should still be
Anything
able to do all the normal amount of work and still be able to get everything done, but you just feel hungry.
That's right.
Gotcha.
And the way you're supposed to feel once you've actually eaten is not hungry. And that is the only thing you're supposed to feel at the after a meal. You shouldn't feel better, you shouldn't feel worse. You should just simply know that you're not hungry. If the answer is anything else, then you've got a problem. And you're basically walking a tightrope throughout your life, throughout your each and every day, attempting to kind of manage your energy levels and your mood and your brain function by what it is you have to constantly, supply yourself with for energy. And if you're using, there's an analogy that I use that I think might be useful for people to kind of understand how this works. And I look upon carbohydrates as basically a form of metabolic kindling. So your brown rice and your beans and your whole grains and say sweet potatoes, etc., these so-called complex carbs that are supposed to be the foundation of the government guidelines for a healthy diet, they're basically the metabolic equivalent of twigs on your metabolic fire. And then your white rice and white potatoes and pasta and cereals and things of that nature are basically the metabolic equivalent of crumpled up paper on that metabolic fire. Now, beer and wine and sweetened alcoholic beverages and sports drinks and sodas and things like that are really the equivalent of lighter fluid or gasoline on that metabolic fire. Now, if you have a wood stove in your home, and that's how you're trying to heat your house, and you live in a cold place, probably not like Australia, but say you live in a colder place, some people can imagine. If you live in Tassie, then this makes sense.
It's pretty cold here today, actually, Nora. I think it got to
Oh, is it?
got to 2 degrees in Sydney overnight last night, so
Oh, well, there you go. So perfect day to make this analogy.
yeah, I'm feeling you.
Right. So you all you have to heat your house is this wood stove. And if all you have to feed that wood stove is, twigs, paper, and lighter fluid, I mean, you could do it. And guess what? Most people manage their metabolism in exactly that way all the time. But what are you actually doing? You're sitting there in front of that wood stove pretty much all day long, whether you like it or not, and you're looking for where the next handful of fuel is going to come from to keep that fire going. And if you go about your business and you take your mind off of that and you get distracted by other things like, oh, I don't know, life, or God forbid, trying to sleep through the night, then all of a sudden you find yourself in a place where you're suddenly experiencing symptoms and you're realizing that, oh my God, the house is getting cold, or you're sitting bolt right up in bed at 3 in the morning. And yes, there's an analogy to be made here too. People that are members of the 3 a.m. club need to understand that the most common cause for that is chronic blood sugar dysregulation. That's a hypoglycemic response, and you're because you're not eating at night, your adrenaline can kick in the middle of the night to bring your blood sugar up, and suddenly you're awake and wondering why. Suddenly your mind is racing and you're thinking, food doesn't sound so bad. Sometimes people get cravings in the middle. That isn't necessarily what happens with everybody, but
Just one quick question on that, Nora. People will say to me, "Oh, I wake up in the middle of the night because I need to go to the bathroom." And I say, "Well, actually, your brain's just trained to make you want to go to the bathroom when you wake up, so that's not necessarily the cause." Do you agree with that?
I do. There are some cases where people have other types of problems that cause them to urinate more frequently. I mean, your body is supposed to diminish its urine production during the night. And in a normal and healthy person, they shouldn't have to get up in the middle of the night in order to pee. But there are some people that have a chronic issue with that. I do agree that for the hypoglycemic person, it's probably just a perception, like you say, in the middle of the night. But there are people that also have other issues where they're just making more urine than they're supposed to in the middle of the night. Obviously, not drinking liquids before you go to bed, yada yada yada, are good ideas. But ultimately, there you are, you're freezing cold, you're looking in the wood box going, holy crap, the fire's going out, and so you're frantically cramming it full of paper and whatever. And you're craving that type of, that type of kindling, right? And because it's become an emergency. But what is the alternative to that kind of roller coaster ride? And that's, we're not talking about the fun kind. The alternative is taking a nice big fat log and putting that on the fire, taking away the kindling as a primary source of fuel, taking that out of the equation, and using a nice big fat log on that fire instead. And now what have you got? You've got a fire that's basically going to burn at a nice, even pace for a much longer period of time. And you sleep through the night and you wake up in the morning and you look and say, oh, look, the fire's burning down a little bit. I'm just going to throw another log on the fire. And then you can go about your business, go off to work, and forget about that wood stove. And chances are, when you get home later in the end of the day, your house is still going to be reasonably warm, And so, with that analogy, it becomes a little clearer as to how this works, I think, that we have cultivated this unnatural dependence on sugar as a primary source of fuel. And all carbohydrates, with the exception of fiber, all utilizable carbohydrates, I should say, are sugar once they've hit your bloodstream. Once they hit your bloodstream, you've eaten that potato, and the enzymes have worked on the starch molecules to break them down into their component glucose. All of a sudden, you have just got a flood of blood sugar that your body has to deal with, and it's a state of metabolic chaos, really. Your body is going to be working very hard at trying to get rid of that as quickly as possible. So insulin gets produced as a way, as sort of a default way of dealing with that. It's not really a blood sugar hormone. It's really more about taking excess nutrients out of your bloodstream and putting them into storage for later use in case of a famine. Really, at base, insulin is mostly about the coordination, actually, of your energy stores with reproduction and lifespan. And that's a more complicated subject, but at any rate, your insulin dives in there. It sweeps the blood sugar out. It tries to take as much of that sugar as it can and inject them into your cells for use as an immediate source of rocket fuel. And that's ultimately what glucose is rocket fuel. It's an anaerobic fuel. It's something that burns very hot and very fast. And then, of course, it has to be replenished really often if your need for it, becomes chronic.
Now, when you
But
say it puts them in, it puts blood sugar into the into the cells, are you talking about muscles there?
well, so your muscles will use a certain amount of glycogen for extreme exertion. You're weightlifting or whatever, you may rely on a certain amount of glycogen for that purpose. Although ongoing throughout the day, your muscles mostly prefer to rely on free fatty acids. But for certain things, your muscles will store a certain amount of glycogen that can be only used by your muscles. And then your liver stores another supply of glycogen that is meant for more general purpose, for increasing your energy levels in case of an emergency. And that's the whole idea, that if you suddenly, and you're wandering through the woods, and this is kind of how our stress response, to kind of bring it back to the original topic a little bit, how your stress response is designed to function. You're supposed to be in a calm, relaxed, basically aerobic, fat burning, parasympathetic, in other words, calm and relaxed state, 99.99% of the time. And then all of a sudden, the saber-toothed tiger jumps out from behind the bush, and suddenly you need that injection of rocket fuel to help you outrun that immediate threat.
Or wrestling.
So, or wrestle them, whatever it takes. Or the ugly date jumps out from behind the bush, or whatever it is, and you've got to outrun that apparent threat, and hopefully you survive it. And then you can go back to your little umbrella drink on the beach, and go back to that nice, calm, relaxed state again. So for 99.99% of everything we need to do, we shouldn't be relying on rocket fuel for every little thing that we do. We don't need rocket fuel when we're sitting on the beach with an umbrella drink, right? The low carb umbrella drink, I should add. You got me. But unfortunately, the way that people are living their lives nowadays, and it's kind of the opposite. People are being chased around by saber-toothed tigers 24/7, you know, and then the other small percentage of the time where they get this fabled thing called a vacation, you know, they go off to Tahiti, just long enough to stress out the Tahitians, and then they come back to their sort of, to resume their chronic state of self-abuse, and they call what they just had a vacation, and they go back to that kind of chronic state of fight or flight. And when you're relying on rocket fuel all the time for your energy levels, you're much more likely to be cultivating a chronic state of fight or flight. And you're demanding a lot of your adrenals in the process. It's really kind of an unnatural state to be in. Our adrenals were never meant to manage our blood sugar in the way that they do today, in this the constant need to kind of increase blood sugar. That is unique to this modern day time period that we're living in. And in it, it's basically a form of self-abuse, is what it boils down to. You know, the thing to realize about cortisol, for instance, and adrenaline for that matter, is that they're catabolic hormones. You know, you've heard of anabolic being something that, you know, we hear about anabolic in relation sometimes to bodybuilders in terms of building up your body. Catabolic is where things get broken down. And the part of your brain that normally mitigates stress response is a part of your brain called the temporal lobes. Those temporal lobes are right above, they're on the sides of your head, right above where the tops of your ears are. And there's a structure in there called the hippocampus, which is responsible for the integration of short to long-term memory and also for mitigating your stress response. And that part of your brain has the richest repository of cortisol receptors of any other part of your brain. And unfortunately, it was not designed to be marinated in stress hormones 24/7. So what is happening, and what I see is perhaps the most common, although it's one of only a few, it's one of a handful of adrenal-related issues that I see, but it's probably the most common, sadly, is that what occurs is that with that chronic cortisol marinade, that part of the brain starts to break down. Now, radiologists are looking at the films of relatively young people today and seeing temporal lobes that look like Swiss cheese. And they're starting to call this a normal variant of aging. And I'm here to tell you that there's nothing normal about this simply because it has become commonplace. And what you end up with there is a big mess, because that's the part of your brain that controls your normal circadian rhythms, the circadian that coordinates those circadian rhythms of cortisol release. Cortisol is supposed to be highest in the morning, when you're trying to get up and get moving during the day. And then over the course of the day, it begins to gradually come down. And by evening, it should be at its lowest ebb so that you can get to sleep. What you see with people that have temporal lobe degeneration or the early stages of temporal lobe compromise are really screwed up circadian patterns. They cannot wake up to save their lives in the morning. This might be a possible pattern. And at midnight, they're ready to rock and roll. Or they have energy crashes early in the afternoon, or they may have trouble falling asleep or problems staying asleep. But there are big kind of weird, peaks and crashes in their energy patterns throughout the day. And when you do a certain type of lab tests called an ASI, which is a salivary hormone panel designed to take several samples, salivary samples, which contain active hormone that measure your cortisol levels at various times of the day, you can kind of then see what type of circadian rhythm that you have. And you can also look at the overall cortisol burden. How much are you producing? Are you producing enough over the course of the day or not enough? And all too often, I see that roller coaster pattern in the graph that tells me, yikes, this person needs to take this problem very seriously and very quickly, because this is the first part of the brain that starts to deteriorate in conditions like dementia and Alzheimer's disease, that it's an early sign. One of the other symptoms that are associated with that type of so-called adrenal dysregulation are people that become extremely forgetful. They can never remember where they put their car keys or their cell phone, or they're constantly, forgetting phone numbers that they call all the time, or they look at the face of somebody they know and go, wait a second, you live with me. I know your name. I know I knew your name.
Which is something that people are now, it's just something that people think is, oh, it's just old age. That's just what happens to you, but it's not normal,
And
right?
it's not normal simply because it is common. The brain is not supposed to deteriorate with age. The fact that it's doing that is not a normal state of affairs. And it is something that needs to be addressed and can be very effectively managed by doing the right things and by avoiding the wrong things. But unfortunately, most people just kind of laugh it off and call it a senior moment, and they don't take it as seriously as it needs to be taken. So that's one particular type of adrenal dysregulation that shows up, are those just weird fluctuations in energy where you have energy at times when you would rather be sleeping, or your energy crashes at times where you really should be able to get up and move. You shouldn't be having an energy crash at 3 or 4 in the afternoon. That's not normal. And blood sugar is one of the key things that can exacerbate that problem, especially that blood sugar based reliant sort of metabolism is something that I think really needs to be gotten under control very, very, very quickly. And in my opinion, blood sugar at that point is only serving to further deteriorate the problem, that you really kind of need to transcend that need for blood sugar and try to adopt more of a fat based approach. To your metabolic, to managing your metabolic needs and the needs of your brain. Your brain runs far better on ketones. Ketones are the energy units of fat. Your brain runs far better and far more evenly and far more, consistently on ketones than it does on glucose. And you can do everything you need to do with the exception of maybe 10, 15% tops. With nothing but ketones. So, and it's the dietary approach I advocate as being the most foundationally sound for the vast majority, I think, of people.
So, what kind of things does someone need to do to shift themselves over to using fat as a fuel source rather
Well,
than
for
blood
starters,
sugar?
how do you get good at doing anything? If you want to be good at playing basketball, are you going to get good at playing basketball by playing golf all the time? You
Probably
get
not.
doing, probably not.
I've been trying that one for a long time.
You get good at things by doing them consistently. And so you get good at burning fat by burning fat, by giving your body that form of fuel and saying, look, this is what you've got to work with. We're not going to that other type of fuel. This is what I'm giving you. And your body will make that metabolic adjustment accordingly. Now, if you're severely hypoglycemic, that can be a very uncomfortable transition. And that may require maybe some extra supplementation, like training wheels for a little while with certain, there's a supplement called L-glutamine that you can buy in any health food store. I'm pretty sure even in Australia that's available. And your brain can use glutamine in lieu of glucose as just sort of a temporary way of getting over those sort of low blood sugar symptoms while you're metabolically adapting yourself to the more efficient utilization of this other type of fuel. And it takes time. It takes anywhere from 3 to 6 weeks, in fact, in my experience, and up to 2 months to be really fully there.
Now, just on
So.
that note, is that because the body trains itself to release cortisol at certain times? Like, I know if someone drinks coffee after dinner every single night, and then they stop 1 week, the body will still be used to releasing cortisol at, say, 9 o'clock at night. And then it takes a few weeks to get over that. So it's normal for people to not feel great when they start swapping over like this?
You know, there's like a whole range of different ways in which people will respond to that change. I mean, some people can adopt this way of doing things and in a matter of a couple of days, they feel better than they ever have. Others find that it's, you know, they feel really fatigued in the first week, for instance. It's like, God, I just have trouble, you know, doing anything. There are a couple of ways you can deal with that. You can use certain supplements. If there are cravings, there are supplements that can help. Or if there are blood sugar symptoms, there are supplements that can help. But also you can do things like eating a more fat-rich and maybe with a little protein, like nuts, for instance, noshing on just a few of those here and there throughout the day to just kind of give yourself something to work with as you go on. But eventually you should arrive at a place where, you know, you can have, I mean, I can have a very modest, meal first thing in the morning. It can be just a small, like a couple of ounces of meat, or I can take and saute up a couple of, say, chicken livers in some duck fat or something like that and season those and nosh them down. And I'm going to be good until noon or, you know, sometime, you know, if by 2 o'clock I haven't eaten something, I might be looking at my watch going, you know, I'm kind of noticing I'm hungry, but I'm still functional. It's just that I'm thinking about eating something. So, but when I do eat, it's not like I'm loaded with cravings. And like, if I don't eat something, I'm going to chew somebody's arm off or bite their head off. It's more like, well, you know, I'd like to eat something. And usually a small amount of something containing protein or fat is sufficient to kind of keep the fire going, on an even keel. So you're able to make better choices when it comes to eating, and you find yourself not craving the things that you used to. Because the only reason people develop these cravings is that they have this unnatural, you know, dependence on kindling. And so you're going to crave it all the time if that's what your body requires to keep going. But when you've made that metabolic transition, that same, you know, that urgency, to eat certain foods that you just thought you couldn't live without, suddenly just kind of goes away, and you start to wonder what the big deal ever was about that. It's like, wow, I used to think I could never live without ice cream, and I haven't eaten ice cream in a while now, and I'm fine. It things change, and with respect to women's health, you know, the health of any woman's transition to something like menopause, for instance. And of course, I'm assuming an older audience, but I don't really know what the age of your audience is. But just with respect to menopause, for instance, the health of your transition to pre, peri, and post menopause is really the health of your adrenal function. That once your ovaries kind of start to shut down their natural production of your sex hormones, it's not that your body stops making them. Basically, those two little smoldering nuggets that were once your ovaries are, you know, taking their last dying gasp and handing the baton to your adrenals. And if your adrenals are not up to speed, you know, if they aren't up to the task, then you're going to be in a world of hurt. You know, in traditional societies, the transition from, you know, from menses to menopause was considered kind of a very respected rite of passage that nobody was afraid of. And I think that it's developed a stigma today in part because we have this, you know, kind of this weird emphasis on, you know, youthful sexuality and all that kind of a thing in our culture, but also because a lot of women really go through hell and high water when their body goes into that sort of hormonal shift. And their bodies aren't up to speed. They're not up to the task of managing their own natural hormone production that's supposed to be taking place postmenopausally. And they get hot flashes and they get irritable and their, you know, everything dries out and they start to lose their hair and and you know, get cold and all kinds of symptoms, that, you know, gain weight, etc. That's not normal, just simply because it is
common.
Yeah. So by really recognizing that all the hormones in your body are basically this complex sort of symphony, if you will, of interrelationships that are all related to one another. And you can't really do anything to one hormone without affecting a whole bunch of them, if not all of them. And your steroidal hormones in particular, which include your sex hormones, in addition to your adrenal hormones, they are like a family. They will function together and they will dysfunction together. And if you can get, you know, the healthy functioning of your adrenal glands under control by supporting the health of your brain and nervous system, there's a tremendous amount that you can accomplish toward normalizing other kinds of hormonal imbalances as well. And I think that there's a tendency today in, and even natural medicine, to run straight for the hormones, whether they be bioidentical or not, you know, or synthetic. And I personally see that as a very big mistake. You know, what you need to do is figure out why your hormones are dysregulated in the first place. Go in there and try to dig deep enough to figure out what the base problem is. And from there, attempt to restore healthy integrity to your hormonal system so that it can go back to managing itself. So when you start throwing hormones, exogenous hormones, at the problem, you know, you're starting to mess up that intricate network of communication. You know, you start to shut down feedback loops and start to create a lot of metabolic confusion. And even though you might feel better at first because you've added more hormones where there weren't any, it's not that your body was too stupid to know how to make enough hormone. It's that there were imbalances present that were your body, and your body was doing the best it could with what you were giving it and what you were doing to it. And your body responded by maybe diverting more, you know, more of its steroidal attention toward the production of stress hormones instead of sex hormones, for instance. Now, if you're in a chronically stressed state, your body is going to preferentially produce stress hormones over sex hormones. If you're getting chased by a saber-toothed tiger, do you think your body gives a rat's patootie whether or not you have adequate estrogen or not? It's not concerned about that. It's concerned about survival, and survival trumps everything else. And too often today, people are operating in a chronic state of fight or flight. They're in a chronic state of sympathetic overarousal. Their nervous system is lit up like a Christmas tree, and they are marinating themselves in stress hormones. So stress management is a hugely important problem. But there are other...
Do you think that can be the reason why there's so much IVF going on at the moment? Because people's bodies are just saying, I'm too busy running from a tiger to worry about trying to get pregnant.
Oh, well, yes. I mean, I think that that can be certainly a part of the equation for sure. I mean, there are a lot of things, though, that can factor into that. You know, extreme low-fat diets and...
Over-exercising.
Over-exercising, yeah. Things like that. You're going to really screw with your hormones. And you're not going to, you know, be in an optimal position of being fertile enough to be able to bring something to term if you're not giving your body the raw materials it needs in order to do that. Absolutely. or you're overspending them on your own survival. Your body will basically prioritize your own survival over the survival of a fertilized egg any day of the week, just to keep you alive long enough so that you could hopefully successfully reproduce another day.
Yeah. It's like what they say on airplanes. You've got to put your own air mask on before you can worry, or your own oxygen mask on before you can worry about doing anyone else's.
Right.
So what would you say would be some of the worst things that people could do for their adrenal health? And what would be some of the best strategies that people can use to help themselves heal? Especially women.
Well, recognize that, again, that we're really designed to be functioning in a very calm, relaxed state most of the time. And the degree to which you honor that natural need that your body has to function in a parasympathetic state means that you are paying attention to your stress levels and that you are doing things that you need to do for your own self-care. I think, you know, we need to pay much closer attention to these issues than our ancestors ever had to. You know, for them, they were out there, you know, hunting and gathering, you know, in fresh air and sunshine and, you know, with the occasional crisis. But for the most part, we're able to lead pretty, you know, pretty even-keeled lives. And we've created this extremely unnatural environment for ourselves. We've even created 24-hour sunlight in the form of electricity. And that screws with our circadian rhythms, too. And that brings us, you know, to another form of imbalance, which is, you know, melatonin, which a lot of people recognize as a hormone that helps us sleep, produced by the pineal gland. That's actually what establishes the circadian rhythm. What mitigates it is the temporal lobes, but your pineal gland is responsible for producing sufficient melatonin at night so that you can get rest. But cortisol and melatonin are always in relative balance to one another. When melatonin is up, cortisol is down. When cortisol is up, melatonin is down. And what I worry about, too, are people taking melatonin supplements, which actually I think are probably illegal in Australia anyway, or they don't sell them over the counter, which is just as well, although I don't believe these things should be illegal. But I think that they, you know, elsewhere, for instance, here in the States, I can go and buy all the melatonin I want, and lots of people use it as a non-toxic sleep aid. The problem is that they're similarly, they're adding a hormone to their system that was not naturally produced by the system. And that complicates things and can screw up those rhythms. And the first way to screw up your cortisol is to take melatonin. So, you know, it's much better to take the things that will allow your body to make more melatonin and let your brain produce it endogenously. In other words, itself, as opposed to taking it in the form of a pill. Another thing, there is a part of the brain called the hypothalamus that is responsible for the amount of cortisol that you are going to be producing at any given time. And there is a small structure of cells in the hypothalamus called the paraventricular nucleus. And that part is of the brain is very sensitive to inflammation. And it's very sensitive to things like cytokine production. Cytokines are inflammatory compounds produced by your fat cells in order to deal with infections and other things. The problem is that, say, for instance, you get a flu bug and your body is going to step up its interferon production in order to increase natural killer cell activity to attack the invading organism. Well, it so turns out that those PBN cells, that your hypothalamus is very suppressed by that interferon. And so if you have a chronic infection of some kind, you have, say, a chronic viral infection that you just don't even know. Maybe it's Epstein-Barr, maybe it's, you know, who knows what, cytomegalovirus, there are any number of viral kinds of infections that people just sort of walk around with. You're going to have a constantly suppressed output of hypothalamic neurotransmitters and cortisol. And your energy levels are going to feel low. Your cortisol is going to be artificially suppressed a lot of the time. And you may not be able to, you know, you may feel chronically fatigued and think that your adrenals are somehow burned out when it's really some kind of underlying state of inflammation or infection that's driving the problem. It's not your adrenals. So that's another form of adrenal problem. The last category I'll mention is you know, metabolic, or rather mesencephalic midbrain dysregulation. Now, that's the part of your brain that has the highest number of that produces adrenaline, and it's also the part of your brain that is most geared towards survival of any other part of your brain. It's very alert to threats in its environment, and it's very, very quick to react to stressors. And so if you have somebody, for instance, who has that part of your brain will control the amplitude of your cortisol response and of your adrenal response. And it's the part of the brain that tends to become dysregulated in a person with, say, post-traumatic stress disorder. And these are the people that, you know, you say boo to them and they just sort of unravel, you know. They like to wear sunglasses all the time. Sometimes you'll even see them wearing sunglasses in the morning or on cloudy days because they can't deal well with bright light. They don't like loud noises. You couldn't pay these people to go with you to a festival, you know, where there were lots of people around, because people moving close to them is just really overwhelming to their nervous system. That's midbrain dysregulation. And again, that is, you know, people think of that as an exaggerated adrenal, you know, response kind of problem. And that part of the brain is typically kind of brought under control through the production of a hormone called GABA, gamma-aminobutyric acid, which is an amino acid. It's also a neurotransmitter. And anything that enhances GABA production is going to be helpful to that part of the brain. Sometimes, you know, L-theanine and, you know, there are a variety of things that can be helpful toward enhancing that calming production. I don't like GABA supplementation by itself as much. But anyway, that's one of the other things. What I did in my book, and I don't know if we've mentioned thus far that I actually have a book on this subject. It's called Rethinking Fatigue, What Your Adrenals Are Really Telling You and What You Can Do About It. What I've done with that is I have categorized these individual types of adrenal dysregulation and carefully detailed them and the symptoms associated with them to help people kind of screen for what might be happening with them, to sort of self-screen a little bit, not necessarily self-diagnose, but to come to a place of, you know, this really fits me. That really, you know, I identify with that. And then I offer a number of suggestions of further kinds of testing you might ask your healthcare provider for to better clarify the situation, ultimately what kinds of things are most likely to help that particular type of problem. You know, if you have the hypothalamic issue I was just talking about, how much do you think an adrenal supplement is actually going to do to help you? It's not going to affect you at all. It's going to be a waste of money. Most adrenal supplements are based on Cellier's model of adrenal, you know, burnout, of adrenal fatigue, and they supply adrenal-friendly nutrients when that's really not the problem or the issue. You know, if you have a chronic infection, you've got to address that. Or if you have, for instance, you're anemic, you need iron in order to produce healthful levels of cortisol. You need vitamin A in order to produce healthful levels of cortisol. Lots of people are vitamin A deficient. Lots and lots of people have insufficient levels of true preformed, you know, vitamin A, you know, retinol, not beta carotene. Those are not the same thing. That's not the same thing at all. And so you kind of have to dig deeper to figure out what the problem is. But for women's health, nothing can be more important than, for women's hormonal health anyway, than the health of their adrenal function. The health of their adrenal function is made healthier by getting blood sugar levels under control, or in my humble opinion, moving beyond the need for blood sugar as you know, as a chronic addiction, as a chronic kind of dependency, and shifting to a more fat-based metabolism. You know, if you want to get good again at burning fat, you've got to burn fat to the exclusion of sugar and starch. When you throw sugar and starch in there, your body's going to burn up the kindling first and save the fat for later. So by taking that kindling away and just relying on that longer burning fuel, your body eventually comes to adapt to that in a much more stable and, you know, and consistent kind of way. And then you have much more even moods, much more even energy, much more even cognitive functioning, and you'll probably experience an improvement in your memory function as well. And I have one peer-reviewed research paper, it's not sitting in front of me, and I forget which journal it was in, that probably a journal of neurology, that showed that a fat-based, basically metabolic adaptation to the utilization of ketones as a primary source of fuel will just automatically increase cerebral circulation and by about 39%. So you can radically improve.
Wow, that is quite a lot.
With which your brain functions. Yeah, yeah. It's an exciting finding. Let's see if I can find that. Here it is. It was from the American Journal of Physiology, so it was not a neurology journal. It was published in 1996, and it was called Changes in Cerebral Blood Flow and Carbohydrate Metabolism During Acute Hyperketonemia. In other words, where you're producing ketones as a primary source of fuel. And this, the authors of this study stated that, quote, a ketogenic state results in a substantial 39% increase in cerebral blood flow and appears to reduce cognitive dysfunction associated with systemic hypoglycemia in normal humans. We're not even talking about disease state. It's very huge. I mean, I could go all day long talking about, you know, the exciting body of literature that's just now exploding in this area. And it's increasingly, you're going to see, and it's certainly happening here in the States, where fat is really becoming now this sort of unrecognized sort of superstar. That healthy natural fat is not the problem. It never was. Cholesterol is not the problem. And in fact, here in the United States, where we have these, you know, typically stodgy dietary guidelines like you guys do in Australia there,
yeah,
that are way outdated, they finally published new guidelines that basically lift all restrictions regarding the intake of dietary fat from the equation. And they're no longer advising against restricting the intake of cholesterol dietarily.
It was a long time coming, wasn't it?
A long time coming. There's still problems with it, and there's still aspects to that that they're missing. But at least it's a baby step in the right direction.
And at least we got people like you out there trying to spread the message. I think I'm definitely going to have to go and read that that article that you just mentioned, because if there's one thing I'll never say no to, it's more cerebral circulation, I think.
No kidding. I mean, we live in a culture where there just ain't enough cerebral circulation going around. I'm here to tell you.
Agreed. So if people out there are listening, which one of your books would you recommend that they go and read if what you're talking about today is resonating? Primal Body, Primal Mind, or Rethinking Fatigue?
Yes.
Both?
Yeah. I mean, Primal Body, Primal Mind provides a real foundational basis behind everything that we've talked about in terms of, you know, understanding the role of blood sugar, understanding the roles of fat in your metabolism and all of that kind of a thing. It's like 15 books in one. It's an enormous amount of bang for your book. And it connects a lot of dots with respect to the various aspects of how your body functions and how these various aspects of your functioning relate to one another. Rethinking Fatigue is very specific to people who are struggling with either, you know, energy-related problems or anxiety-related problems, and they're looking for specific answers. But they're going to, you know, I make a lot of references to Primal Body, Primal Mind in that ebook, Rethinking Fatigue, because there's a lot of foundational stuff that it helps to understand in order to make the best use of the information in Rethinking Fatigue. But, you know, neither of these books were written just to make a buck. In fact, I make maybe 50 cents a copy in Primal Body, Primal Mind. So it's not like I'm out to, you know, just trying to rake in the big bucks. I wrote the book because I wanted people to have a tool that would allow them to experience a state of self-empowerment when it comes to their own health and well-being, where they don't have to rely on me or some pill or, you know, whatever for the rest of their lives, but that they can have an inherent understanding of some of the basics about how their body works so that they can walk into a grocery store and just know what to do. without having to try to figure out what their blood type is, which don't even get me started on that, or look at some kind of percentage guide or something like that. There's common sense stuff. There's a common sense way of thinking about this. And I supply the science and all, the evidence that I had available at the time that I wrote the book in a way that I think is relatively easy for the average person to understand. In fact, I've been thanked a lot by people, with only very basic educations, because they felt that they suddenly, they weren't treated like a dummy, but things were explained to them in a way where they now felt like they understood things better than they were ever able to before. And that's very flattering for me to hear that. And I hear it a lot. So I feel really good about the way I wrote it. But there's also stuff there for the geek or for the skeptic or whatever to go and rifle through and see what it is that these concepts are based upon. I supply more than 100 pages of peer-reviewed literature in Primal Body, Primal Mind. And Rethinking Fatigue is also very well very well referenced. So, there should be quite a lot of information that should allow the average person listening to this to be able to make sense of their health in a way that they may not have been able to before. And that's what's rewarding for me. And it doesn't mean that you don't ever need, any kind to go have a medical appointment, to go see your healthcare provider ever. But when you have better information about how your body feels and functions, you can ask your provider better questions. You have better understanding of what might be going on. And you better understand the things that you have within your own control to, to improve the way you feel and function in your everyday life. And that to me is, that's what gets me up in the morning.
I think you've hit the nail on the head there. I think any coach who can really teach people how to go and do it for themselves and be empowered rather than needing to keep coming back and keep coming back and keep coming back is the one who's going to deliver the greatest value. So I think you're definitely on the right track, and I 100% support you with that.
Thank you so much.
Nora, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. You've given us all a lot to think about and a lot of good information as well. But
it's been
a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you, David. It's been a pleasure being here. And I hope that your audience is able to benefit from something they've heard today.
I'm sure they will. Have a great day, Nora.
Thank you, David. You too.